Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. But whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. This week on the Dev Team, we're going to talk about the Joel test. What is it? What are the test questions? And how could they apply to you? Alrighty, we're going to go ahead and start out here by talking a little bit about what is the Joel test. Is that something I'm sure, as developers worth their salt, you guys have heard of before?
I have absolutely heard of the Joel test before.
Ryan, do you go through the Joel test at all with the company you're with or with other companies you've worked with?
Oddly, not specifically. Obviously, a lot of the things on the Joel test we absolutely take care of, but you know, it's not. We don't talk about the test so much anymore. It's pushing 21 years old. I think when you wrote that blog article way back in the dark ages of the internet.
So what you're saying is you can just kind of rebrand it and call it your own these days now.
Yeah. So this week on the Dev Team, we're going to talk about the Mark test. Works like that, right? So that said, yeah, the Joel test is a series of questions that companies can ask themselves to basically find out if they're in a productive situation as a development team. And ideally, companies should be hitting all 12, but that's not always the reality.
Yeah, it's funny because you talk about the Joel test and it's, you know, generally speaking, if you're asking someone who knows what these 10 topics or 12 topics are, you can generally reply yes or no. But at the same time, like, if you've never heard of these things before, what are they? And, you know, if I'm a company and, you know, I'm trying to figure out, like, how do we improve our, you know, software cycles? How do we improve, you know, our release production, things of that nature? What are these things? What are the 12 steps that Joel recommends, right? And Ryan, you alluded, it's 21 years old, right? Like, how do we write modern software?
I wonder how many of our listeners know who Joel is.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Joel on software. Joel Spolsky, I think is his last name.
He's done some pretty big deeds in the field. But I think if you're a newer developer, you might not have heard of the man himself. Back in the day, obviously he was a bit more of a voracious blogger. He's got some books to his name and stuff like that. But you know, most folks haven't even heard of Fog Creek anymore, right?
That's probably very true. Actually.
They have, however, heard of his more recent venture, which is Stack Overflow.
Stack Overflow. Yeah. I think I've seen that before.
Yeah, yeah, it may be something people are familiar with. So
that place where you go and ask a question, and everyone just throws hate on you, right?
Unless that question is specifically, how do I get better at jQuery?
Just use jQuery. I'm sure there's a plugin for it.
So yeah, Joel, kind of, you know, like I said, legend in the industry. Done a lot of things you will have heard of, even if you haven't heard of the person. So, the Joel test. Joel put out some really great articles all around the same time, and the Joel test back in 2000, I think it was, right? And I think even today, all the things, most of the things in there are still super pertinent. And I think a lot of people are still struggling to do some of them today, right?
So, yeah, I would definitely say people struggle to hit all 12 of these, right? And so maybe let's just go through them and talk about what they are.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Whether or not you're doing them.
One last thing I want to add just for people listening and maybe so you don't tune out here. And how this could benefit you is, you know, if you're in your position, you're a junior developer and you're looking for a company, I think this can also be a great way to assess a company is start asking them these questions. You're interviewing with that manager. Hey, you know, I just had a quick couple of questions. They always ask you at the end of an interview if you have any questions. And if you say no, you've already failed. We know that. But these could be decent questions to ask to find out what's the kind of company I'm getting involved in. And if they say no to some of these questions, well, start to assess maybe what you're going to be walking into, especially if it's your first job. Do you want to walk into a place that's potentially just a hot mess?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea behind the Joel test is if they're hitting, you know, somewhere around 5 to 7, I think is kind of the average for, you know, companies that are doing okay, then, you know, it's probably okay to step in that. If you go in and you can only answer yes to a single one of these questions, that may not be the best place for you unless you're going to go in and try to take the reins and improve, which as a junior developer, I would not recommend that.
Yeah. If you're being hired as the, you know, director of engineering, maybe that sounds like a challenge that you want to deal with.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and dive into the questions here. The first one is, do, and I, in my opinion, the probably one of the most biggest red flags if they say no, do you use source control?
I mean, is OneDrive considered source control?
Oh boy. How about a USB? Jake, you've never been down that
road. Oh man. So
if you've got five USBs,
you know, you just have to, everyone puts their own code on each day and then you pass it around and you know, that's part of stand up, right? I mean, but those teams are probably also not doing stand ups.
But it, you know, as on a serious point, and in 20 years ago, this may have been a more pertinent question. My consulting days, I did occasionally run into people that still weren't really using source control or potentially not using it properly. But I've not seen a dev shop for a long time that's not using source control.
Yeah, I mean, it's been what, 8 years, something of that nature, since I worked at a big company here in town. And one of the developers on our team, who just so happened to be the lead, older guy, didn't want to learn source control. So legitimately, we were passing thumb drives around just a couple of years ago, and that's at a massive, massive company, right? Now, we were a small team within that massive company, but it still definitely happens, right? And I would agree that, you know, as things are progressing, that is starting to become less and less. And I think maybe the modern day question of this is, do you use source control, and what system of source control are you using? What strategy are you using? It doesn't have to be Git, right? But what strategy are you using, and does that strategy make sense for the system that you have in place?
I think to extend on that a little bit too, do you have some sort of like branching strategy? It's not only about source control in general, like, okay, yeah, we can roll back and we can roll forward and we have commits and blah, blah, blah. But are you using branching strategy appropriately? Do you have a production branch? Do you have a separate development branch, a separate testing branch? You know, some people are lucky enough to have separate testing.
And you're branches. Laughing, but I don't have long lived branches, so I don't have any of those things.
and that's a design, right? There's different. And that's kind of, I think Jake alluded to that a little bit, is you don't have to follow this, like the Git flow, I think is what that particular design is called. But do you have some sort of strategy that involves, hey, I have production code, and when I push code, I can push to places other than production?
Yeah, and I think one of the big questions that I would add on to, you know, do you use source control today, is do you do continual integration? I think, you know, what is the average time before a developer merges code? I think is a big question today, because I still have folks on a team that, you know, oh, we commit at the end of the iteration. I'm like, no, you don't. That's not a thing.
Right? You're hitting a couple of the Joel questions here too. Right. So we can move on to number two. Can you make a build in one step?
I think the one step is an interesting, thought there, right? Like, can you make a build? Sure. I can run a script that will run a build. Is that, locally in development? Is that build into production? Is that, you know, do you have the right credentials to publish into production? Right? Like I feel like that's always been a question that I'm like, okay, well, in what regard can you make a build in one step? Right. There's a lot that goes into making a build. So what type of build are we talking about?
And I think, you know, going back to the Joel's original question, I don't think it's necessarily about are multiple things happening? You know, are you identifying environments and doing different things based on that, you know, through the automation or not? I think the point is, can I hit a button and have something running from the latest committed code? Right. And I think the answer, again, you know, this is, you see a lot of this kind of push in the kind of DevOps space and around the build automation and management, right? That's a lot of people are trying to get better at it. But again, going back to what Mark said about branching strategies and stuff like that, there's a lot of reasons you might not even be able to see the latest, you know, the latest commit that's going to production. Right. Now a build to me doesn't just mean production. It could be a dev build, could be something I need to run locally on my laptop. And one of the things we see with automation in general these days is we try to make sure that the automation is intelligent enough to work anywhere. Like, if I clone your repo, I should be able to run the build files, right, the make file or whatever that happens to be, and that should work on my laptop. And if the, you know, GitHub Actions wants to run it, it should work there too, right? And if it's somewhere else, it should work. Like, ideally, that automation should have enough intelligence in it to figure out where it's at and what it's doing. You know, we use Mac and Windows across the board. So our scripts have to handle things like backslashes versus forward slashes, right? And, you know, a lot of the scripting tools out there give you ways to take care of that. But you could be lazy and not take care of it. And, well, it doesn't work on my machine. Oh, you're using a Mac. You need to change all the backslashes to forward slashes. Well, that's not going to happen by, right?
I mean, that's part of like the niceties of containerization, right? Like in having like GitHub, VS Code's got the new dev containers, which I can't remember if we've actually talked about that yet on the podcast. I know we've talked about it outside of the podcast for sure, but you know, what dependencies does this project have? And when you boot them up, you know, let's make sure that when we start this project, all those dependencies are in place, right? It's real nice when you have a container that just kind of takes care of all that for you.
Well, and that's a cool thing about a dev container. Ideally, the dev container should have everything it takes to build and run your system. So could you not just reuse the dev container as your build agent?
I think the other thing too to be mindful as we go through these is, yeah, of course it has been, and I did double check, it released in 2000. So it has been 21 years. So things have changed, right? In the original article, it even talks to, you know, whether that build output is CD-ROM. Well, I don't know how frequently you're building.
Not doing that too often these days.
To a CD-ROM. So some of that stuff does, you know, change. And here's kind of another one that I think is with modern source control and stuff like this. I mean, you may not need this as much, but do you make daily builds?
Yeah, and I think this is tying back into that exact same conversation that we're talking about, right? Like, do you have a CI/CD pipeline, right? Is that a daily build? Do we need a daily build? Well, maybe at the end of the day, like everyone checks in their code, and did we check in good code? Did we check in bad code? Do we have some sort of, you know, system in place to say, okay, well, I've checked in code, but you know, it's not feature complete, which is, you know, common. So it shouldn't be a part of that daily build. And do you have that segregation in place? I would hope so.
Yeah, no, that's definitely, and you think about it, there's definitely some big open source projects that still do nightlies, right? And you can, you know, subscribe to that and be using that particular version. But, you know, again, when you start looking in the realm of build automation like that, you start looking at things like feature flagged. You know, feature X isn't ready. So I can't half implement feature X and give you the build. It's going to crash all over the place. So I'm just going to hide feature X till it's finished. But if feature X isn't finished, why was it merged to begin with? Right, it, those feature branches might not be long lived, but they probably shouldn't be merged until the feature's finished. And so, you know, going back to the do we do nightlies, I think a lot of our build and automation tools have evolved to the point there we don't necessarily need nightlies. We build automatically when new changes happen. No changes got merged yesterday. I mean, what's today's nightly going to do? It's going to look like yesterday's. Nothing's changed. But even if I come out with three changes today, I've probably built three times. So I think, you know, it definitely still happens. I think, again, you see a lot of orgs struggling with this. This is not something a lot of them are geared up for, especially with a lot of compliance and regulatory things. Oh, we can't release changes that often, you know, and how do they address that? It's a different conversation. But I think, again, you've got to get your build systems and automation in order before you're in a space where you could do that anyway.
Yeah. And again, I think that's one of the, definitely the ones you take with a grain of salt. This one, however, I think is still pretty, pretty up to date. Do you have a bug database or are you tracking, bugs in your application? And we've talked about bug tracking before and, you know, keeping those logs or opening tickets or kind of the different tracking processes and their approach to them. But I think, having a bug database is absolutely still a necessary thing.
You guys still write bugs in your code? Why?
My code's bug free. My mistake. I just have issues every now and again.
Oh, so you're a GitHub user.
Okay. There you go. Right. Exactly. And that's what I mean. Thank you. I was leading into that. The bug database, in my opinion these days, is now built directly into the source control solution. Right. And that's a really nice thing. Right. We start talking about like Jira and we start talking about, you know, these different ticketing style systems. A lot of times they can tie into and automatically open issues within the repository. They can close issues based upon commits, messages and things of that nature. That's a really nice system to have in place. And GitHub does it in and of itself, as long as you just know the keywords to say in your commit messages.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think you've got to sort of set up a little bit of automation around how that works. Right. But absolutely. And I think we use a lot of, Azure DevOps work management. So we use GitHub for repositories, Azure DevOps for work management. And you know, every time, you know, you can open a bug as an item, a work item, right? It's not a task. It's not a PBI. It's not a story. It's a bug. It's a special type of, it needs to be fixed. And so, you know, again, some of those can be triggered from, hey, somebody opened an action in your repo, go dump a bug on the thing. So I think, yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of those capabilities are now embedded in the tools themselves. And, you know, going back to Joel's original test, I mean, one of Joel's big pieces of software was, a bug tracking system, if I recall, That was one of the big things that Fog Creek did, was a bug tracking database and system. And this was back when, you know, people are using like, you know, Tortoise SVN and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, there wasn't kind of systems. Again, you look at our distributed kind of source control systems today, they weren't the same systems we had 20 years ago. And they certainly weren't platformized like, you know, what GitHub and Azure DevOps and Bitbucket have done. They were, you know, got a tool that runs on your laptop and, it makes sure you're checking in and checking out files and locking them properly so that nobody can step on your toes. But it wasn't what we're used to today.
Yeah, no, it definitely wasn't. And, you know, I think that's, you talk about, you know, having a bug being submitted and, you know, an issue being raised, and it's a special type of thing. And I think this may even go to the kind of the next topic on the Joel test, but that's, you know, what priority does that bug take? Right? Is it something that has to be fixed immediately within the sprint, right when it's raised? Is it not? Is it, you know, how do you prioritize your bugs?
Yeah. And that's one of the things that they, on that test specifically is, you know, do you fix bugs before writing new code? And one of the things that's very interesting is back then he calls out when Microsoft was creating Word, and it was a nightmare. And they kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed, and they were pushing and pushing and pushing and had problems and problems and problems, and then they finally got it done. But one of the things they found out as they kind of looked through and spoke with the project managers is they were so focused on hitting the deadlines for features that they put off bugs till the end. And okay, that's a choice. But what that brought about is people would go back into code that they wrote months ago and had, I don't know, as I have this experience all the time. I'll go into code and I'll go, man, what was I thinking? Right. And it was so much harder. You have to kind of refamiliarize yourself with that certain part of the code, and then you can fix the bug. And it just took way longer to fix the bugs when they did come up, because they just got pushed off and pushed off and pushed off till the end. Oh, you know, we just got to get these features done. We got to get these features done. And they're just rushed and have a bunch of bad code.
Yeah, you know, having that's a major issue, right? Is there's a bug. I know I just wrote it, or I've had those situations where I'm like, I'm going to write this down and dirty just because, you know, I got to hit this deadline and there's some issues in here. I'm going to drop maybe some anchors, you know, some comments, some fix me's. While it works, it's brittle, right? It's brittle code. And sometimes based upon, you know, that push for the next big feature, push for the next big feature, sometimes you leave that brittle code in place and it's really bad. And if I didn't take the time to document it, or if, you know, maybe I'm a junior developer and I'm afraid to call out what I know is probably bad, but you know, I don't want to document my atrocities, right? Then they don't. And yeah, of course you come back and you have that whole, like, who wrote this mess? And you check it was yourself. You know, that's pretty bad. You know, but I would also say this is not it's not a super easy, like, yes, no answer, right? If you say, hey, we always fix bugs before we write anything new, there's certain people that I'd be like, okay, well, that could be boring. You mean I'm just going to be putting out fires all day long and I never get to write anything new? I never get to do feature development. That's lame. And I don't want that job.
I mean, that's an interesting take on it. I think, you know, one of the challenges, so here's the thing, fixing a bug, especially one you didn't write, is probably technically just as challenging as writing a new feature. So, you know, and it's probably infinitely valuable to the user. I think the challenge is, obviously, bugs are just one element of technical debt. And I think technical debt, like any debt, is something that you can acquire, and it's not bad to acquire it. Like, you're going to acquire it one way or the other. Like, you know, it's what you do with it and how quickly you decide to pay it down, right? As to how it affects you down the road, right? And I think I've read some studies recently for some research I'm doing, and, you know, I think something like the average enterprise can potentially carry around about $200 million of liability in the form of technical debt, right? And what does that mean? I mean, that means I might not be able to adapt to market conditions, like COVID last year when it kicked in and everybody was kind of scrambling to, let's work from home, let's do all these things. If you had a ton of technical debt that got in the way of that, you performed less than your competitors, right? Who maybe had paid down that debt and were able to pivot a little quicker and adapt to that changing environment. You don't know what tomorrow holds. Now, not every bug needs to be worked on straight away. Not every bug's a sieve or whatever. So some bugs, you're like, well, I can afford to keep that debt for a little longer. The problem is when you go to, I can afford to keep that debt forever. You can't keep that debt forever, right? And whether it's a bug, whether it's a poor architecture or some other form of debt that you have, you know, not decided to pay off, and that includes operations debt and things like that, you know, ultimately it can come and, you know, hit you when you don't want it, or when you least need it to be. So it's absolutely something you've got to manage better. Bugs are obviously the one that's in our face as developers all the time, but there's a lot of other things that go on behind the scenes, like architectural decisions and things that were made 4 years ago, 6 years ago, 21 years ago, right? Does this still apply? Have we refactored enough? I think most engineering managers, I think, are well aware of it and what needs to be done, but you're right. It's, you know, from the business side of things, from the customer side of things, more feature, new iPhone, please. You know, don't care if your factory is running a little behind. More features, more new phone.
And again, you oftentimes look at it. That's what consumers, you, or from a service level, that's what consumers say they want. We want more features.
Instant gratification, right? But in reality, like, you lose customers in your product over a faulty product more than if you have a feature.
Oh, and you think about a big ticket problem like insecure. You look at the iCloud messages or iPhotos leak or whatever a couple of years ago. I mean, this is a huge deal. And you know what? The average consumer didn't stop buying iPhones, but a lot of people were like, "Whoa, that's not a thing." Right? You think about, other issues you get cropped up. You know, leaks that happen in big organizations where data has been exfiltrated because of reasons. It's like, you know, that's because somebody didn't take care of something that they should have sooner, right? You know, there might not be a vulnerability on this version of Python today, so we haven't updated. But at some point, you know, especially if it's a non-supported version, at some point it's not getting security patches anymore. Somebody gets a zero day on it and you haven't fixed it. You're like, oops, it's a little too late. You know?
And your company has to have a ton of clout to survive a problem like that, right? And you throw an Apple in there, Apple's fine, right? They have so much clout, it doesn't matter. Right, Microsoft's kind of in that same boat, but CodeWorks, no, I'm sorry, like, we don't have that type of clout where we could afford to, you know, have a big vulnerability like that. So, you know, that goes into play as well there for sure.
When you talk about vulnerability, even, and you mentioned, technical debt and the COVID and such, but one of the things you saw there is, yeah, the major corporations, these big companies thrived and boomed. It's the smaller places that definitely got hurt because, again, they have companies that have technical debt. If you're smaller and you have less people and less fine, you can't take that hit, you go under. And that happened not just in the software world, it happened all over the place. But, ultimately that's something as any company, even the big fellows should be aware of that, because otherwise you're going to take a hit and it really just matters, can you survive that hit? So moving into the next one, and this one I'll also add some context to. So do you have an up-to-date schedule? So again, when this was written, Scrum was like barely off the ground. 1995 Scrum was kind of originally produced, and it wasn't until 2001 that you get kind of the big players of Scrum, kind of put together the Agile Manifesto and get that ball rolling. And so this I might even consider modernizing to, are you working in an Agile development process? Are you using Scrum? Are you using Waterfall? Is there a plan in place for how you organize the production of work that's done?
Yeah, you know, and obviously we're big fans of Agile development, right? We're big fans of Scrum. Mark, you're a certified Scrum master, right? I believe Ryan,
and you guys, certified Scrum developer. Thank you.
Oh, well, yes. Sorry about that.
Aren't you both?
That was a couple episodes ago. Obviously we have some biases maybe towards the Agile development life cycle. It works well for us. It works well for our purposes. I have to throw in there the concept of, you know, Scrum butt, right? There are many ways of managing a product and many ways of, you know, managing a dev team and building software and things of that nature. And I would say, you know, there's maybe not necessarily the one and only right way, but I think there's definitely some poor decisions, right? Or some poor ways of managing that type of project. And, you know, not having a schedule of any kind, of course, is going to be a poor implementation of trying to build something. But a lot more goes into play between, you know, what is our method for organizing the schedule?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of us here have probably worked Waterfall as well, which is why we're keen on Agile. I think definitely there's pros and cons to each, depending on the type of solution you're building or trying to solve for. I think one of the challenges that came out of the Waterfall kind of way of doing things is, and, you know, going back to technical debt, you have a specific budget and a specific start and end time. And whilst that product may then be supported from an operational perspective for years, there's no more money or people assigned to it from a development standpoint. So any debt you accrued exists. Any debt that's added to the system through vulnerabilities and changes, they exist. I mean, you know, and you're not necessarily tackling them in a proactive manner. And so that's obviously where the product mindset kind of shifts that. You know, you've obviously got to have a product in mind. It's got to be something that has value ongoing, or how are you going to pay for it, right? But, you know, that's the big difference we see between, you know, project and product. That project, that set end time and that set budget, when it's gone, nobody's working on it anymore. And it doesn't mean it won't develop inefficiencies and problems over time as it scales and things like that. So, you know, and sometimes, okay, we'll get a burst of money next year or in 5 years for an update of some type. But, you know, hitting a system that hasn't been touched for 5 years, is, you'll know what that's like.
I think the other thing that really comes into play of having kind of that plan and that structure is you can really help to avoid things like scope creep, and really laying out that definition of done, so that it doesn't become the, oh, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this too. Oh, wait a minute. What if we did this? Oh, that'd be great. And now it becomes the definition of what you need to produce is kind of amalgamous. And now it's like, well, we got this feature going, we got that feature going over there. And oh, yep. Well, now we're out of budget. So you have to really kind of make sure that there is some kind of structure, some sort of planning in place anywhere you go, that they have kind of that structure to say, okay, yes, we do define what is a specific project or product, and kind of how they organize themselves to know what should I be working on every day? Cause even something as simple as a product backlog, you know, it's instead of just, hey, you need to build this thing. Okay. What do we have left to do? I mean, I'll let you know when it's done. Just keep going.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, it's one of the challenges I have. I you know, when I'm training a lot of folks new to Agile, you know, one of the big hurdles they have is not necessarily understanding, you know, all the terminology and buzzwords and ceremonies and stuff. It's really thinking about developing iteratively. And you know, a lot of devs have this kind of perfectionist mindset. Oh, no, it's not finished yet. It's not finished yet. No, I can make it better. I'm actually going to refactor it already into a new version of Python because, you know, I can make it better. And that just came out. And I'm like, you haven't even released it yet. You're supposed to finish this in an iteration, right? And so that's definitely a big mindset shift for people. And obviously, when you have a long-running project, like you don't have to show any value till the end. Of course, you can sit there going, I'm gonna make it perfect. And the thing is, that's generally going to get in the way of all the other things you've got to do. So it's a big mindset shift. And that's one of the big hurdles we have to get new developers over is it's okay to only have, you know, this piece of value delivered in 2 weeks because you can build the next piece of value in another 2 weeks. You don't have to have all those bits of value on day one.
I know that's something that I personally struggle with too, right? And you have those developers who go rogue, right? It's like, oh, you know, I need to work on this thing, but yeah, you fall down that mistake of, well, it's got to be perfect. And if this has to be perfect, that means this other thing that I'm tying into, well, that has some mistakes. So now let me go make that thing perfect. And let me go back and reiterate on the same thing over and over and over and over again.
I don't know any developers like that.
False. You know, it's definitely it's something where if you don't have a clear schedule, I feel like absolutely you can have those developers who are just amazing on your team, but you never seem to get any work out of them. But they're good. They can solve bugs. They can solve issues. You know, they can write new features incredibly fast, but they seem to just always fail to produce. And it's probably because they don't have, you know, the proper restrictions in place.
There's nobody in any of my teams like that.
All right. I hope they're not listening, Ryan. That was rude.
Well, he has many people on his team. Maybe he's not talking about all of them, but one. That one person needs to figure out who they are. Get in line. All right. We're going to move on here. Do you have a spec? Do you have a code spec? How important is that?
I would say specs are very important.
The following line to that question is, writing specs is like flossing. Everyone agrees it's a good thing, but nobody does it.
Ryan, I think, isn't your entire job around like putting together specs for different systems, you know, different...
Not if I can
help. I thought you did DevOps.
So I think, you know, obviously... Well, when we talk about spec, we're talking about kind of a scope, right? We're talking about, you know, have you kind of, and again, in the Agile world, this is a difficult thing to apply in a lot of ways because of the fact that, well, I don't necessarily know the end goal when I start. I'm going to get there over time. Now, you probably already have some constraints defined, and you've probably got the basis of a spec because of that. Like, this needs to happen, this needs to happen, and this needs to perform in, you know, this kind of way. And so, you know, but it's not necessarily like, you know, when you were kind of putting an RFP out for like a, you know, $2 million development project, you know, you have to have a very detailed spec. This is what I expect for my $2 million and my 2 years of investment or whatever time it's going to take. As we work iteratively, obviously things work a little differently. I mean, architecture in Agile itself is very different. When you're doing architecture in a kind of continuous Agile fashion, you know, you don't necessarily have all those details up front. So you need to be mindful because you're still building a software system that requires that kind of thought process up front without necessarily, you know, hamstringing yourself one way or the other, right? You know, we do, you know, a lot of what we do is APIs these days, and we do lead with a kind of design first approach around those. So it's like, okay, we will design the interface. And the challenge with APIs in Agile is APIs, especially platform APIs, are rigid by nature. You do not want to break the contract. So once you define the contract, which you're supposed to do fairly early on, right? Now I can't introduce a change to it. If I introduce a change to it, it's a breaking change. That's going to annoy my customer. My customer shouldn't be on version 30 of the API by the end of next year. But if I'm building it Agile, you know, and I'm building it over time, how do I avoid that without doing a ton of upfront work, right? So it's a fine balance there between, you know, good design and good patterns around, you know, the design of the API and what you can actually deliver and iterate on without introducing breaking changes. So, you know, we have a design first kind of spec. You know, we talk about our best practices and our design patterns. We go, okay, we want to make sure you do this. We want to make sure you do this. We want to make sure you do this. You know, as long as you're taking all that into account as you go through the motions, like, that's good. We can move forward to kind of coding and testing, you know, doing all the rest of the life cycle. But that's, you know, a lot of people are like, well, that doesn't seem very agile. You designed the whole spec first. I'm like, no, I designed the spec for the bit I'm working on this iteration. And next iteration, I'm going to make sure the spec's done for the bit I'm working on there, right? You don't have to have a complete spec with every endpoint, every method, right, on day one, because you're not going to have any of that code on day one. So why does it matter?
Yeah. And, you know, and that's one of those things, too, when designing that spec and, you know, not wanting to introduce breaking changes, a lot of times you can be additive without having any breaking changes, right? It's when you become subtractive, right? When you start taking things away is when you start introducing those breaking changes.
Well, and that does satisfy the letter of the law for sure. The challenge is there, and I've talked to some, you know, folks who design APIs and interfaces for fairly big, you know, systems that maybe handle billions of requests a day. That the challenge there is, you know, changing the behavior of a system in any way. There's likely someone out there using it in a way you didn't intend for it. I remember talking to one person, an example. They shaved the response time in half, 50%, so it got down to like, you know, sub-second kind of execution. But somebody had built something around it that basically required that 1 second because it did some weird triggering. and so their thing stopped working and they complained, oh, you've made the API too fast. It doesn't work for me anymore because I was using this particular thing. And you're like, but that's
bad. That's you're wrong.
You're using the delay time from the comms. So call it from Australia or something. Like, I don't really know what you want me to do. And that's the thing. There will always be people that use your system in a way you didn't intend to, especially when you're building platforms. And that's obviously, now, again, you know, you've satisfied the letter of the law. I don't think anyone's going to question you that, no, sir, that's not a thing. But you're still going to upset some users occasionally. And you know, sometimes they can be, I mean, look when Facebook changes the way the bar looks, the amount of people that go crazy. Oh, my God, I hate the new site. It looks terrible. I'm going to go back to MySpace.
Well, you know, but I can understand that from the perspective of my wife's grandma, right? She's 96 years old and she's using digital devices, right? She's using these platforms and she knows exactly where she has to go to click certain things, right? And she's kind of got a little bit of poor vision. And so, yeah, when you introduce even a UI change, right, it can throw a lot of people. So, you know, those are things that, as we talked about, like maybe you should be able to opt into the new design system and things of that nature before you just force it on people.
I am dreading the day that old.reddit.com goes away because I still only use that one.
I think, let me extend that too a little bit. And it doesn't even matter, just like old people or anything, but like Ryan, apparently. I'm just kidding. But consider, like, we make tutorial videos, right? Several of our videos might use a tutorial using a different version of an app that come time that student goes to watch that video and is trying to set up, like, we use Auth0. And about as soon as I changed or I published those videos out for our students, they changed the UI.
Yeah, that's just called job security, Mark.
And so it's stuff like that. You know, it's now that continually I have to keep these up to date. Every time that interface changes, I have to go update it so that it reflects appropriately for what that student's expectation of that site visit is. Now, ultimately, should companies, you know, hold themselves to the exact same layout because, well, I have to make tutorial videos? Of course not. But I think there is something to be considered with avoiding frequent changes to something like that. That kind of drifted, though, from, I think, the original thought there. So I'll move on to the next one. And this one, I think, might be a little bit of debate. I think most of us are kind of on the same page, but I know people who are not. Do programmers have quiet working conditions?
Is that a requirement?
Yeah. So, you know, for myself, I am, spoiler alert, a social person. Those of you who haven't met me, but for those of you who have, that's no surprise. But that said, I think that for me, I don't necessarily need perfect quiet. In fact, I can just work fine without. But I even know people who, and several of our students, who work better if they have like a movie on in the background, which would drive me crazy, or music on, or their specific, you know, there's some sort of noise going on that it doesn't need to be quiet. Now, that could be a definition of quiet. Like, ultimately, can they work for so many hours without having to go to a meeting or without being interrupted? I think that's a different definition, but maybe still applicable.
Yeah, you know, I definitely agree. I'm more along the lines of I want quiet, right? Like, I will put on my headphones. I will put on, you know, some sort of music that I definitely don't know the lyrics to because I don't want to actually accidentally start singing along to anything, right?
And worse, writing the
lyrics. Right? Like, I don't want that. So I usually will put on, like, some sort of instrumental music and, you know, whether it's, you know, a Bach or Mozart or, you know, or it's some sort of, you know, dubstep. Like, it doesn't matter to me as long as it's my choice of music for how I'm currently feeling, but it's quiet and I don't want those interruptions when I'm sitting down to develop things, right? And you know, sometimes I'll put my headphones on and not have any music playing just so people leave me alone. Cause I need that quiet.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going back to, you know, the type of things Joel used to write about 20 years ago. I mean, I remember one specific thing. He basically described what they did at their New York office and how they built it out and how they, and how every, you know, the way they laid it out, they had these weird angled offices so that every developer had their own space, but also still a window. Right. And like in a city like New York, that's not cheap floor space. Right. Like, you know, I come from London. I totally get it. Right. And I think, you know, playing into that, especially back then, you know, obviously we've got access to fairly affordable noise canceling headphones these days. You know, it's not like it was back then. But, you know, being able to have an environment that you can control and set up to your liking, I think is more the point of the question. Right. And that's not something most developers 20 years ago had. Here's your cube farm. You can hear every phone call for like three blocks. And right, and that's how it's going to be, and go get your job done. And obviously, you think about today, half of us work from home now, half of us are going to continue working from home if that works for us. Some of us who are, you know, we can go into a space where we do have other coworkers and stuff like that, right? And it's like, you know, that's kind of, it's a totally different situation, right? There's so much more, I guess, freedom of choice for us now than there used to be. I think a lot of developers are probably a lot more comfortable in being able to kind of customize their space and do their thing. I mean, there's still companies out there that thou shalt come into the island. We've talked about that on recent podcasts, right? You know, if you must be here, but are you providing them a space that's, you know, useful for them, that gives them kind of the ability to be their best, or are you not? And, you know, I think
Are you providing daycare? So my kids don't interrupt me. I need quiet. So can you just take my kids?
I think I'll add to that, though. I have been I worked at a company for a while and they had an open floor plan. And not only was it open floor plan, but it was also like go find your own desk every day. And it was kind of it was fine for the role that I was in there, but I felt, looking back on it, I feel horrified for the developers that, hey, every day go find a desk, whatever works for you. So first of all, you don't really have your own space. Nothing's personalized. And they did have kind of a cubicle layout, but they were half cubicles. They were not full height walls. So you could literally see across the entire building and see every single person. And again, in the role I was in at the time, it was fine because it was somewhat of a social role. But I could not have done open floor plan as a developer. I do enjoy people, and I do enjoy kind of having that conversation, be able to say, hey, real quick, let me ask you a question. And most of the time, when Jake and I shared an office, he'd never listen, but just asking that question, that kind of rubber ducky thing. Or if I said something real dumb, he'd be like, oh, wait, hold on, say that again. But I couldn't work with that completely open floor plan. I think there are plenty of companies that still do things like that. And you have to kind of decide, and this is why I think this is a good part of that interview questions, is are you okay with that? How are you productive?
Yeah, I think that's very much a personal choice question, right? And I like what Ryan said. It's, you know, the job of the employer is, you know, can I make changes to my working conditions if I need to? Right? That's what I think is probably truly important there.
Well, you're potentially paying people a lot of money. Like, you want to get the best out of them. You don't want to put them in a situation where they're not able to give you what you hired them to do comfortably. You know, they're just going to go somewhere else at that point if it's a regular thing. So, you know, I think it's important that employees take that into account. I think, you know, especially in the dev space, I do see a lot of that. I think people understand the value they're getting and what they need to provide to their staff to kind of, you know, get that value out of them and keep them comfortable. Because, you know, you can't sit there thinking hard all day if you're not in a comfortable working environment, right? It's just not going to work.
Well, speaking of, that kind of brings you to the next one. Do you use the best tools money can buy? And I think that that comes to applicable. And usually when we think of this, like, my first thought is, oh, software. Are you getting me the best tool software? But this applies to hardware too. Like, do you have, you know, do you supply your developers with a laptop? Do you supply your developers with a second monitor? I know that I can develop on a single monitor, but good Lord, I just having multiple monitors is just so much easier and so much more productive. For myself, that you can also bring ergonomics into this whole argument.
And when you say, like, do you buy the best tools money can afford? Or so I think that was the question.
Do you use the best tools money can buy?
Yeah. I may need a secondary monitor, but I don't need, you know, an ultra 8K, like, you know,
six, curved.
Yeah. No. Like, I don't need that. So I don't think that's a requirement, but, you know, I do want some, you know, I want something reliable, right? I want something that's not going to fail. You know, and I want something that has at least a high enough resolution that I can use it. Right. And talking about software, like,
but not too high that you can't use it.
Yeah. Not so high that you can't use it. I'm looking at Microsoft right at this moment. it's, I think, you know, that's one of those from a software standpoint, do I have the tooling for the language that I'm using, right? Like, if you're forcing me to be a .NET developer, you know, I'm writing in C#, and you're not going to give me access to Visual Studio, why? Like, I think, yeah, that would become the responsibility of the company, right? Like, I'm going to need that developer account, right? Like, I'm going to need my MSDN account. Like, I don't know how you're not going to have that.
I think that also comes back to training a little bit too, right? You started to touch that with direction, but like a Pluralsight account. And I think that there's certain things that, you know, how, and that's not like fully covered in here, but I think that that's can be squeezed within here and fit well within those lines is, yeah, do you take care of your developers when it comes to continued education? Hey, I need this book, or hey, I'd love to go to this conference and things like that. And I get not everybody can afford brackets conferences and stuff like that, but you know, are you giving them the best that you can is maybe the better way to put that. Not the best tools money can buy, maybe the best tools your money can buy. Well, and that's feasible and affordable for your company.
I think sometimes too, like, some people have that misnomer, the illusion of like, oh, we're gonna go out and buy the most expensive system we can possibly find because surely it will just do everything. And in reality, like, you may be buying a terrible system for your use case, right? But I've seen people who will just simply try to throw money at a problem to make it go away. And oftentimes it doesn't, and it can introduce more roadblocks, right? Like, thinking about like, hey, if I, you know, we're going to integrate with, you know, this brand new platform that does document management for us, but it's super convoluted and terrible to work with, you know, that's maybe not always the best thing either when a simple solution would work.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, someone put a great interview question on Twitter the other day. They're like, you know, like, if you, you know, when you're interviewing, ask them how complicated it is to buy a $50 book, right? What is the process for buying a $50 book, right? And that's a key indicator of what the hurdles might be. You know, we were talking about this internally recently. Like, if I need approval to buy a $100 book or a $2,000 conference ticket, you know, that's cool. But why do I not need approval to set up a meeting with 16 people that make X number of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year? That's a very expensive meeting, which you put absolutely no boundaries on, but you make me jump through hoops to buy a book. It's an odd place to be. And it speaks to culture a little bit. All right. But I think, you know, going back to the, you know, best tools money can buy, I think, you know, I think Jeff Atwood, the other co-founder of Stack Overflow, he's talked about this a few times, and it's kind of like, you know, him and Scott Hanselman both, I think, have these ultimate developer builds where they've kind of kitted out these machines for them. And it's like, when you're writing compiled languages, like every time you want to check it works, you have to build it. And now if you've got your standard corporate laptop, because that's the policy, like, what does that take? What is my wait time every time I want to try? I changed a line. What do I get out of that? I got to hit this button. Are you going to take me 40 seconds to build? You can take me a minute to build. You're going to do it in 4 seconds. Like, buying the right equipment for your staff to do their job well and efficiently is easy money. You know, it may look silly when you go, oh, well, most people have these $500 laptops. Why should you get a $4,000 one? I was like, well, you pay me X per hour and you will get more work out of me. I used to have the same battle before multiple monitors were common. I remember one job, I actually brought one of my monitors in from home. They're like, no, we're not buying a second one. You only get one. And so I brought one of my second ones in because I can't work with one monitor anymore. And I remember the CFO walking past my desk one day. He's like, oh, is that your second monitor? And I was like, yeah, you know, and he sees me. God, I've got Excel up in one. I've got like a terminal open in the other or something. And he's like, oh, you know, we should definitely get you a second one so you can take the one back home. And I'm like, right? And it's just like, this was not too long ago either, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but you know, I remember these conversations used to be hard. And I think, you know, especially in the rest of the IT space, like in the development space, I think there's always been developers add value, right? So we give them tools and capabilities, and a lot of orgs still look at IT operations orgs as they cost money. They're just there to, you know, we have to pay them because, you know, otherwise things go wrong. So just keep pouring money into it, but we're not going to give them all the bells and whistles. And that can definitely, you know, that again, going back to that, you know, that can definitely sour some relationships between dev and ops to begin with. But, you know, it's not like an ops job is any easier. Like, I got to keep the lights on for everything. I've got to make sure it's all working. Trying to do that with one monitor on like, you know, 4 gigs of RAM laptop, right? It's frustrating. So I think it's important to invest in your people, especially if you're paying them that kind of salary. Like, that's, if you want to extract the most value out of them, you've got to chip in for it, right? And it's not just salary that makes them who they are.
So Ryan, if my code compiles in 4 seconds as opposed to 40, when am I going to take my lunch break?
You eat lunch in 40 seconds?
All right.
While Mark's trying to debug it for you.
Yeah, right. Hey, speaking of, I think it is about time for new laptops, actually.
I think it is actually this
year. We'll talk about
that later. You should all get those framework laptops.
All right. let's get this wrapped up here. We got two more. So do you have testers? We've kind of beaten this horse a bit over the years in this podcast, or the 2 years. And I think we can all agree that testing is important. Testers as an isolate job, though.
So I think this is one of those things where, you know, I've talked to software consultant agencies, you know, the presidents and people running them, and one of the things that you know, I've heard said is, you know, if you're going to a client and the client's like, well, I don't want to pay for testing, I've seen a lot of those consultants say, well, hey, if you pay for upfront testing, we won't charge you maintenance fees. Right. Or something of that nature. And it's funny how many people will choose to say, well, no, fine, I want to still pay a maintenance fee, as opposed to, you know, spending the extra money up front to write good, reliable tests. And when something breaks and you're in debug mode and, you know, you have a consultant who's putting in 60 hours a week trying to fix this, you know, fire, put it out real quick, all of a sudden you've spent a whole lot more money. And if you would have just had testing up front, right? I think testers is a crazy important role for any organization. And I mean, we could talk, I think, for days on automated testing, manual testing, you know, and the different theories behind how you test, right? I would say, hands down, if you don't have testers, you should.
I think one of the specific callouts that is in there is, you know, the difference between having a developer write their test versus someone who writes tests, write the tests, and that it's significantly cheaper. Typically, someone who will either do manual testing or automation testing, they write those tests, are typically cheaper than the high-end senior developers. because they're more focused in that one niche. And that's one of the call outs that Joel makes. I don't know if that's how much that's held true over time.
I like writing my own tests, so I could just say return true.
You know, assert is true. Return true.
You know, so we don't generally have dedicated testers on most of our teams. Our, you know, part of our definition of done is if you're writing code, you're writing tests, right? It's not untested code, right? So, and you're right that, you know, when you get to a certain level of the team, that might be costing more money, but it's not necessarily the same person writing tests. I could have junior person on the team writing some tests. So you don't necessarily always want the person who wrote the code to write the tests, because they're kind of already looking at it from one perspective. And part of the testing process is maybe trying to hit it from a different perspective. You know, going back to, you know, the software kind of companies and stuff. I mean, I remember when we used to kind of price that stuff up, again, it's part of the definition done. I'm not selling you a tester that you can opt out of. I'm selling you, you know, development time, which unfortunately for you includes testing, because I'm not putting my name to work that's not tested. And then you're going to yell about it. And, oh, it doesn't work. Well, what did you expect? Right.
I think there's that argument for test driven development as well. You know, that a lot of that's written ahead of time by maybe even somebody else entirely.
Well, and, you know, I think Google was a big proponent of there's a test-driven development framework out there that you write a whole bunch of tests and then you say generate code, right? And it generates everything else based upon your tests. I can't remember exactly which framework that is, but I know Google has that.
And we have similar tools around our API specs. You write the spec first and it'll scaffold out your whole project for you. And now you just have to put the business logic
in. I know Gherkin did that a lot with BDD. Behavior-driven development, you'd say, hey, here's a behavior I expect, and it would generate the code for the test. But we also have Copilot for that now, too. All right, we'll go ahead and round out the last one here. Actually, there's two more. I can't read. Do new candidates write code during their interview? This one's a...
Hasn't this one gone full circle in 20 years?
I think it depends on the candidate, right, fully. Are you hiring
a junior? Are you hiring a dev, right? Yeah, junior, senior, I think that could play into it. I think it's, are you doing a, you know, esoteric whiteboard, you know, algorithmic, you know, who cares? I Googled this, I memorized it right before I came in, or are you actually writing code, right? There's a difference between those two things. And I think a lot of companies, you know, have made that mistake of, well, let's just, you know, have you stand at a whiteboard and give you some, you know, awful challenge, and if you haven't seen that one before, you most likely fail it, and if you have, you look like you're, you know, the smartest person alive. And I don't feel like that's a good evaluation of skill.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it's definitely not those, I think the worst questions of those whiteboards, like, ah, gotcha kind of questions, like, oh, you didn't know this one trick way of doing it. Oh, have you ever heard about this method that you'll never use in the rest of your life? Can you invert a binary tree? Well, how often will I be inverting binary trees in this job? Well, you know, and you see those, right? And I think that they're good, and we could talk about this in another episode entirely, how to do good technical interview questions, but you definitely need to assess their ability to read, write, and understand code in some way or another. Maybe not so much in Ryan's job.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree. We don't generally do, I try and avoid the dreaded code interview, right? You know, I mean, there's definitely times that I can catch you out. I think for the most part, if you're asking the right questions, you can generally get a feel for someone's kind of ability to do things. And you can also show them code and have them kind of walk you through it. I mean, there's plenty of options that, I mean, I've just heard so many horror stories about what the dreaded coding interview has become these days. Well, it's an 8-hour interview. There's some take home parts. They want me to redesign part of their system. I'm like, dude, give them your hourly rate then. Like, why are you redesigning part of their system? You don't have the job yet. Right. So I definitely see where, like, obviously Joel's initial kind of test has kind of gone full circle and maybe backfired in a lot of cases. But I absolutely think he's right. You've got to be able to ask the right questions and get a feel for if this coder can code. You know, if I'm hiring a chef, I'm probably not just going to talk to them. Okay, well, here's the kitchen. So let's talk about what can we do with it. Right. And, you know, maybe put, you know, when you go and buy a wedding cake, it's like, can I get samples from you, please? Because I'm going to pick one based on whether or not I like your cake. If I don't like your cake, I'm not giving you $1,000 for a cake. Right. So, you know, I definitely think it's about finding the right balance and the right type of it. And I think, like you said, Mark, you got to understand the candidate and the role and then kind of work out what the best way to approach that is. And that's hard when you're interviewing tens of, let's say you're going for a rapid growth phase and you're hiring tens of developers a month or something. Like, how do you, it's not necessarily, you know, you can't necessarily give them that kind of individual care and attention. So how do you do it? And that's when you get this kind of, well, we just have a standard whiteboard thing, and they take this home, and I'm like, right? I think it's one of them double-edged swords right now. You gotta be.
So I think what's funny is take the pizza as a service example, right? When interviewing, right? We'll use the chef as the example, right? Like if you're interviewing a chef and you say, okay, look, you have to actually cook me something that I can taste and evaluate. There's a difference between saying, here's my kitchen, here's all of the ingredients, here's what I want you to make, versus saying, well, now go home, you go buy the groceries, you go source everything, you put it together, and then bring it back to me, and then I'll eat it.
As a trial, cater this event of 200 people for free.
Right. That's a big difference.
And between, please draw up the chemical makeup of guacamole.
Right. That's definitely, there's some data structure questions that you get, or, you know, what is this particular thing? Exactly. All right. The final question you can ask here is, do you use hallway testing or hallway usability testing? And that's more of a UI question that basically says, hey, if I had somebody, do you have this idea that basically you have other people try and use your code and say, hey, here's my product, can you use it? And again, I think this is something that I don't see as much in the developer space because I don't do as much in UI as maybe I could. But I do know, and we've spoken with several people who are UI testers, this is still a big thing. And depending on the product and whether it's software as a service or kind of depending, I think, your space, there's a lot of beta testing and that type of thing that says, hey, they actually have hired out other companies that find developers. And you can actually even do this on yourself online. You can sign up to be a usability tester.
Yeah, you know, I think usability is that interesting thing. Like, I just recently had this experience where, you know, I was building something brand new. Didn't take the time to build out like the UI spec ahead of time. I built it. I thought it seemed really easy to use. And then I turned around and handed it to, you know, some of our employees, and they didn't know where the buttons were. They didn't know what they were supposed to click on to add the next item. Like they, and it was one of those things where I was like, well, what do you mean you don't understand that? Like, this is super simple. But I had written it, you know, I designed it. I all came out of my own head, and, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, just simply adding a couple extra labels would make a world of difference, but those weren't there when they were first introduced. So, you know, I released this project that I want my employees to start using, and now all of a sudden they're like, I don't even know how to use this thing. And, you know, I think some of that comes into that play. Like, if it's, you know, before or ahead of the release cycle, it's, hey, jump in here, look at this, evaluate this, look at this with me, right? Does that look like a good decision? You know, and I think that's kind of that random usability testing.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap it up there. We appreciate you all sitting through these 12 questions, and certainly Google those. You can look up the Joel questions and you'll be able to find pretty much all that entire list, as well as probably several commentaries and maybe even updates on them. Do you guys have any other last minute things you would add to your own Jake or Ryan lists of things that all companies should be doing? You thought I was going to close right there.
I wasn't expecting that question. I mean, like I said, I think the list is still very poignant today. I think we can easily see where things have evolved, and we've answered part of the question, and now we're answering another part of the question. You know, I think, you know, I was going to touch on that usability question a little bit. It's, you know, you think about when the test was written, you know, MySpace wasn't even a thing. Right, social networks weren't a thing, but I notice now on LinkedIn you'll occasionally see a post from a UI person, A or B, like it or celebrate it or whatever. Tell me which one you like best, and you'll see a couple more of those. And you know, the hallway kind of test is nice, especially when we're all back in offices. But this year, you know, I haven't been able to grab anybody aside to do this kind of thing. So having platforms like that available to us to collaborate and kind of get that kind of instant feedback, I think. You know, I know you guys have some design tools you use yourself for wireframes and stuff, but absolutely right. You've got to get some feedback from people who aren't you, and potentially people who aren't on your team, because your team generally has a little bit of comfort with the way you do things as well, right? But no, I think the questions, still very poignant today across the board.
Yeah, for me, it's maybe depth on some of them, right? That's already handled. And you even touched on it there with wireframing is, you know, if I were to go to a company and it's like, hey, when we build applications, who's in charge of like the design aspect of it from both the UI design and the data architecture? Because I think those can be two very big things that if as a developer, you're just said, hey, go build this project. Or this product or whatever it might be. And here's a vague description of it. Good luck. you know, you've already made a lot of mistakes. And I think that there's, that's where you need to have that. You have, we use Figma, I think is probably what you're referring to, but even a good, you know, MS Paint layout or something to give me some sort of general idea, whether it's a wireframe or whatever, of what I'm aiming for when it comes to the client side, or just a simple UML diagram to help understand the data architectures. So that would be one that I'd make sure is, you know, more specified in that. Do they have kind of that? Is there a plan in place?
Well, I think part of that's how I see that, you know, the spec question and how I see that has evolved these days, especially around internal teams. It's like, do I have a development standards? Right. Do I, you know, and that's the kind of thing you talk about data architecture and data modeling and stuff like that. You know, if I'm building a big system of systems and I've got a bunch of different teams working on different subsystems, if I don't have that kind of defined at a top level, they're all going to solve it however it works for them. And then that's not necessarily going to give me an easy interface at the top that I can present out to the outside world. So having that kind of standardization of, you know, this is what we expect for this type of object. This is what we use for property names. This is the format we use. And the same goes for design, having some kind of designer at that kind of, you know, product ownership level who can say, regardless of what product team you're on, this is the design of our interfaces. This is the design of our UI. This is our standard CSS file that has all the base theme stuff. I mean, having that kind of stuff already taken care of makes developers' life a lot easier because, you know, a developer didn't necessarily go down the designer route, right? And, you know, so they might need that guidance. And you know, having somebody steering that when you're dealing with a bunch of different teams, I think is very important.
Yeah, I would definitely agree that it's crucial, right? To have the templating in place, right? If you're expecting your devs to, you know, build this product, you know, we've talked a lot about like the continuous integration pipeline. I, as the junior dev stepping into the project, shouldn't be responsible for setting that up, right? That should be a, you know, maybe I type in a couple commands, maybe we generate this project for the very first time, we add the collaborators, but all of the rest of the things that can be automated away have been automated away, right? And even down to the theming, the theming's been set, you don't need to modify it, you don't need to change it, right? Like that to me is that extra little piece that, you know, if we could add a step 13, it's, you know, do you have the templating in place for your company spec, right? And that would be kind of, you know, my final recommendation there.
All right. Well, we'll leave those recommendations and we'd love to hear from you. If you have any other ideas or recommendations, things you think that should definitely be a part of any spec, go ahead and throw us a comment or again, shoot us a message on Slack or drop one into our GitHub. We'd love to hear from you and that'll be it for us today. That's a wrap for the dev team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.